Welcome to the Deep Dive. Think back to the last time you bought a car, or maybe even just thought about, the economics of owning one these days. How much has really changed in just a few years?
Yeah, quite something, isn't it?
It really is. Today, we're diving deep into a fascinating corner of the automotive world, Group 1 Automotive Inc., ticker GPI. Now, this is a Fortune 250 company, a real giant in auto retail, and they're facing, well, what the sources are calling a truly pivotal moment.
Exactly.
Think of this as your shortcut, your way to get a handle on a sector that's grappling with some massive shifts. We're talking everything from big economic pressures to the huge impact of electric vehicles.
You know, what's really interesting here, I think, is you have this company with a proven track record, a solid history, operating precisely when its industry faces, well, the sources call it a great normalization on one hand and a structural threat from EVs on the other.
Two big forces pulling potentially in different directions.
Right. So our mission for this deep dive is really to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge from the investment research, the company reports you've shared. We want to help you understand how GPI is trying to navigate these powerful, sometimes conflicting forces.
Perfect. So throughout this deep dive, we'll first unpack GPI's core business model, how they actually make money. Then we'll zoom out, look at those big shifts happening across the auto retail world.
The seismic shifts, as you call them.
Exactly. We'll tackle the looming EV challenge head on, see how Group 1 stacks up against its rivals, and finally, really decode the financial indicators that matter.
The goal is you walk away with a much clearer picture of this, let's face it, pretty complex industry and where a leading player like GPI fits in.
Okay, let's get started. So to begin, who exactly is Group 1 Automotive? Before we get into all the industry tremors, let's just lay the groundwork. What do they do? How do they operate?
Right. Absolutely fundamental. Because to really appreciate the challenges and, the opportunities ahead, understanding their basic business model is key. Group 1 isn't, just a corner car lot. They're a sophisticated omnichannel operator.
Omnichannel meaning physical and digital together.
Precisely. They're a leading international player in auto retail, a Fortune 250 company, as you said. Now, their physical footprint, as of the end of 2023, was pretty extensive. We're talking 199 dealerships and 41 collision centers.
Wow, that's a lot of locations.
It is. And it's strategically split. They've got 144 dealerships and 28 collision centers spread across 17 U.S. states, and then another 55 dealerships with 13 collision centers across 34 towns and cities over in the U.K.
So big U.S. presence, but international too.
Definitely. Although they did sharpen their focus a bit, divesting their Brazilian operations back in July 2022. So it's primarily U.S. and U.K. now.
And you mentioned omnichannel. It's not just about the physical dealerships then. I remember reading about their digital platform, AcceleRide.
Absolutely. That's crucial. Their physical presence is sort of seamlessly blended with AcceleRide. That's their proprietary digital platform. And it's not just a website to browse cars, It's designed to let customers do a lot, potentially the whole purchase, online. It really integrates the physical and digital.
Making it smoother for the customer, presumably.
That's the goal. And their core activities go way beyond just selling cars. They sell and lease new and used vehicles, sure, but they also arrange financing, sell service contracts, insurance contracts. They provide maintenance and repair, and they distribute parts, both retail and wholesale.
So really cradle to grave for the vehicle lifecycle.
You could say that. It's a full service operation. They aim to capture revenue across the entire ownership experience.
Now, something that caught my eye in the research was their strong position in Texas. They're number one there. What are the pros and cons of being so dominant in one specific region?
Yeah, that Texas concentration is fascinating. Being the number one auto retailer there gives them significant advantages. Think about regional scale. It means more efficient advertising, better inventory management across dealerships in the state. Operational synergies.
Like sharing resources?
Exactly. Centralizing some functions, building strong local brand recognition, maybe even getting better terms from suppliers because of their volume in that market. But as you hinted, there's a flip side.
Risk.
Geographic risk, yeah. If the Texas economy takes a hit or specific state regulations change significantly, Group 1's performance could be disproportionately affected compared to a more geographically diversified competitor. It makes them more sensitive to local issues.
Makes sense. And all this activity, this structure, it's guided by a specific strategy, isn't it? Something about four pillars?
That's right. Their overarching strategy is very explicitly designed to maximize shareholder return, and it does rest firmly on these four pillars. The first one is portfolio and operations optimization.
Sounds like keeping things lean and mean.
Pretty much. It involves discipline, M&A mergers and acquisitions, but also strategically selling off underperforming dealerships. And just a constant focus on efficiency, making sure they have the right dealerships in the right places, running as effectively as possible.
Okay, pillar one. Optimize the portfolio. What's next?
Pillar two is leading customer experience. This ties into that omnichannel idea we talked about. It means using technology like AcceleRide to improve the whole customer journey, from buying the car to getting it serviced years later, making it smooth, satisfying, low friction.
Which is huge these days. Customer expectations are so high.
Absolutely critical. Then pillar three is internal, being an employer of choice. This is all about attracting and keeping skilled people, especially technicians. They're vital for the service side. So it means development, good compensation, a positive work environment.
You need good people to deliver that good customer experience.
Precisely. And the fourth pillar ties back to the car manufacturers themselves, being an OEM partner of choice. This means building strong, collaborative relationships with the original equipment manufacturers, Ford, Toyota, BMW, all of them, working together on things like getting enough cars, marketing, handling recalls smoothly. It's about being indispensable to them.
Okay, four pillars guiding the ship. Now let's get down to brass tacks. How does Group One actually make its money? The sources talk about four pillars of revenue, and it sounds like there's a really crucial distinction within that.
Yes, this is absolutely fundamental to understanding their business model, particularly their profitability. Here's the key insight. New vehicle sales and used vehicle sales, these bring in the lion's share of the revenue, huge top line numbers. But
they don't make much profit on each car.
Relatively speaking, no. They're low-margin, high-volume activities. Think of them as the engine. They drive customers to the dealerships. They build up the number of cars out there that will eventually need service, what the industry calls the vehicle park. Selling cars gets people in the door.
Okay, so that's the engine. And what are the other two revenue pillars?
Those are parts and service, P&S, and finance and insurance, F&I. These are the profit centers. They contribute a much smaller slice of the total revenue pie.
But they pack a much bigger punch, profit-wise.
Exactly. They generate significantly higher gross margins. This means the overall health, the resilience of Group One's entire business model is heavily dependent on the stability and, hopefully, the growth of these high-margin P&S and F&I segments.
So a small dip in service profits hurts way more than a small dip in car sales profits.
Disproportionately so. That's the central risk here, understanding GPI's future. A relatively minor percentage drop in, say, P&S gross profit would need a much larger percentage jump in vehicle sales gross profit just to break even on the bottom line. And achieving that kind of jump in car sales profit is incredibly tough in a competitive market. It really highlights the vulnerability.
That makes total sense. It's like the classic 80-20 rule, maybe even more skewed here. What about the specific car brands they sell? Does it matter which brands they have franchises for?
Oh, absolutely. It matters a lot. Group One has a diverse portfolio of 36 automotive brands, but the industry is really seeing this split, this haves versus have-nots dynamic playing out among brands.
Meaning some brands are just doing much better than others.
Right. You have resilient brands, think Toyota, Lexus, BMW. They have strong consumer demand. The manufacturers are managing inventory well. Dealerships selling these brands are commanding higher valuations, seeing better sales momentum.
And the have-nots.
On the other side, you have some brands, like, say, the Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram Group, often called CDJR, facing real headwinds, maybe too much inventory, weakening demand, which pressures dealer margins. So Group One exposure, how many strong versus struggling brands they have, is a key differentiator. Having more of the haves helps them ride out market bumps better. It definitely influences their M&A thinking, too, aiming for quality franchises.
Okay, that brand mix is important. Let's shift now to how management actually uses the company's cash. The capital allocation strategy seems like three main levers: M&A, share buybacks, and dividends. And those buybacks, the numbers are pretty staggering.
They really are. Management's capital allocation strategy is clear, it's consistent, and yeah, quite aggressive, especially on the buyback front. M&A is definitely a core growth pillar. Group One has been a very active consolidator. Since the start of 2021, they've bought businesses that added up to a cumulative $8.8 billion in annualized revenue.
$8.8 billion in acquired revenue. That's huge consolidation.
It is, and it's ongoing. Just in Q2 of 2025, they bought three more U.S. dealerships, a Mercedes-Benz, a Lexus, and an Acura store. Those are expected to add about $330 million in annual revenue. Management always emphasizes they're disciplined on valuation, though. They're not just buying anything. They want deals that add long-term value.
So M&A is big, but talk about the share repurchases. You said that was the really standout lever.
The scale has been genuinely massive. Since the beginning of 2021, GPI has bought back 5.8 million of its own shares. That's almost a third, 32% of the shares they had outstanding at the start of that period.
32%?
Yeah.
In just a few years.
Yeah. And the pace in 2022 was particularly intense, about 18% of shares bought back in that single year. Reducing the share count like that gives a powerful direct boost to earnings per share, EPS, which is obviously a key metric investors watch. It's also a very strong signal for management.
A signal that they think the stock is cheap.
That they believe their stock is undervalued, yes. And that buying it back is a highly effective way to return capital to the remaining shareholders.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, especially for you, the listener. We have this massive buyback program boosting EPS, but the auto industry is staring down the barrel of this huge capital-intensive EV transformation. Don't they need money for that? For charging stations, new tools, technician training?
That's the crux of the tension, isn't it?
It raises a crucial question. Is pouring billions into buybacks the most prudent long-term use of capital right now? Or could that money be better deployed, maybe, future-proofing the business more aggressively for the coming EV wave? It creates great short-term returns, boosts the stock price, but does it potentially mortgage the future?
It's a very valid question, and analysts debate it. And while Group One does pay a regular dividend, it's relatively small compared to the buybacks. The yield is modest. It clearly signals that repurchases are their preferred way to return capital right now. It's a strategic choice, prioritizing that EPS boost and total shareholder return via buybacks.
Okay, fascinating strategic choice there. Now that we have a good handle on Group One itself, let's zoom out. The wider industry. The sources describe it as undergoing significant upheaval, moving from that post-pandemic boom to, well, something else entirely.
Exactly. This period is what the research calls the Great Normalization. It's basically a return to more typical market conditions after a couple of truly bizarre years. But it's not just a simple return to the past. It's layered with these new external pressures.
So remind us, what made 2021-2022 so unusual?
It was unprecedented profitability for dealers, driven almost entirely by supply chain chaos, especially the semiconductor chip shortage. New car inventories just dried up. That scarcity gave dealers incredible pricing power. No discounts, sometimes even paying over sticker price. The result was record high gross profit per unit GPU and peak profits for the whole sector.
Right, I remember reading about that. So normalization means that's over.
Largely, yes. By 2024, new vehicle inventory levels had mostly recovered, getting back towards pre-pandemic norms. And guess what happens when supply comes back?
Pricing power shifts back to the buyer.
Precisely. Dealers have less leverage, manufacturers start bringing back incentives to move the metal. And the direct impact is that material compression in GPUs we're seeing across the industry. Group One's own results show it clearly. Their new vehicle retail GPU dropped a sharp 18.1% just from 2022 to 2023.
Ouch. That's a big hit to profitability per car.
Yeah.
So the big question is, where do things settle? Do GPUs just go all the way back to where they were before the pandemic? Or is there a new normal that's maybe a bit higher?
That is the multi-billion dollar question for GPI and its peers. It's the huge variable for future earnings. Everyone agrees the crazy high 2022 GPUs aren't coming back. But there is a view, you hear it from management, that maybe some structural changes, like manufacturers being more disciplined about production, maybe consumers sticking with more F&I products, might mean GPUs settle above the old pre-pandemic levels.
A kind of soft landing for margins.
That's the hope. Whether that actually happens will determine if the next few years are tough but manageable or really quite challenging for profitability. It's a really key thing to watch.
And it's not just inventory normalizing. There are these big macroeconomic headwinds too, right? Especially interest rates. I gather they hit dealers in two ways.
They absolutely do. It's a double whammy. First, higher rates increase the dealer's own borrowing costs to finance the cars sitting on their lots. That's called floor plan expense. So it costs them more just to hold inventory.
Okay, that's one hit. What's the other?
The second and arguably bigger impact is on consumer affordability. Most people finance car purchases. When loan rates go up, monthly payments go up, and fewer people can afford the car they want, or maybe any new car at all.
And those rates have gone up a lot, haven't they?
Dramatically. Cox Automotive data from March 2025 showed average new auto loan rates near 9.7% and used car rates, they were almost 15%.
15%? Wow.
Yeah. Combine those high rates with car prices that are still historically elevated, and you've got a major affordability squeeze. Group One's management has talked about this directly on earnings calls, saying consumers are squeezed by high prices and interest rates that have basically doubled.
How does that squeeze flow through to GPI's business?
It hits multiple areas. It suppresses overall demand for new and used cars. Some buyers just get priced out. And it puts pressure on that high-margin F&I segment. Now, interestingly, GPI's F&I performance has held up remarkably well so far. Their F&I per unit actually increased slightly in the U.S. in Q2 2025.
That's surprising resilience.
It is. But persistently, high rates can still make it harder over time to sell financing, extended warranties, things like that. It might reduce the penetration rate for those products. So maintaining that F&I resilience is going to be a challenge if rates stay high.
Okay, a tough environment with rates and normalization. Now, shifting gears a bit, the U.S. auto retail market used to be incredibly fragmented, lots of small dealership groups. But his sources say it's consolidating rapidly now.
That's a major trend, rapid and sustained consolidation. The scale is pretty remarkable. The top 10 dealership groups in the U.S. now control over 9% of all dealerships. That's an all-time high.
Why is this happening now? What's driving it?
It boils down to the need for scale. Being bigger gives you advantages. You need scale to afford the huge investments in technology and digital platforms everyone expects now. You need scale to manage diverse brand portfolios effectively. And you get operational efficiencies from centralizing functions, better purchasing power, things like that.
So bigger is better in today's auto retail world.
It seems to be the prevailing logic.
And Group One, they're not just watching this happen, they're part of it.
Oh, definitely. They are an active participant. M&A is a core part of their growth strategy, as we discussed. But the M&A market itself is evolving. We saw some of the biggest public buyers, like Lithia, maybe tap the brakes a little in 2024. That might have opened the door for some big private groups to get more aggressive. It's getting more competitive with more of these mega dealers emerging.
So the question for GPI is, how do they compete for the best dealerships against potentially even bigger rivals?
That's exactly it. And the focus of M&A is changing too. It's less about just getting bigger for the sake of it and more of a flight to quality. Dealers are targeting the best franchises, your Toyotas, Lexuses, Porsches, and high growth markets. They're also more willing to sell off underperforming stores. Group One's recent deals for Mercedes, Lexus, Acura fit that quality theme perfectly.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, let's address the elephant in the garage. Electric vehicles. EVs. This isn't just a new type of car. It feels like a fundamental rewiring of the whole industry, and maybe the biggest long-term structural challenge for the traditional dealership model.
I think structural challenge is exactly the right term. And the core issue, the most profound implication for dealers like Group One, is the direct hit to their after-sales revenue, their parts and service business.
Because EVs just don't need as much maintenance.
Fundamentally, yes. They are mechanically much simpler, far fewer moving parts. No oil changes, no spark plugs, no exhaust systems, none of that routine high-frequency service work that ICE internal combustion engine cars require. It completely changes the service equation.
And the forecasts for how much less service revenue EVs will generate, they're pretty scary for dealers, aren't they?
They are quite stark. Various analyses suggest EVs will likely generate somewhere between 40% and 60% less service revenue over their lifetime compared to a similar gasoline car. Deloitte estimated workshops could see a 30-45% drop in revenue per vehicle as the fleet electrifies.
40 to 60% less. And P&S is their highest margin business.
Correct. That's the critical link. Given P&S is GPI's profit engine, a long-term structural decline in that revenue stream would severely impact their overall profitability if they can't find ways to replace or offset that lost profit. This is the potential profit cliff people talk about.
So faced with that cliff, what's GPI's strategy? The source is kind of painted as a race against time, make hay while the sun shines with gasoline cars, but also get ready for the EV future.
That's a very good way to capture the dynamic. You see, GPI intensely focused on growing its current P&S business. Maximizing profit from the existing ICE fleet seems like a strategic imperative right now. But management isn't ignoring EVs. They acknowledge inventory is building faster than sales. They see the margin pressure from EV mandates in the UK.
So what are they doing to prepare?
They're investing. Training technicians for high voltage systems, that's crucial and expensive. buying specialized tools, diagnostic equipment needed for EVs. They increased their U.S. technician headcount by 6% recently, investing over $25 million to boost productivity and keep those techs happy.
So building capability for the future while trying to maximize the present.
Exactly. And while the old service model is threatened, EVs do create new, different service opportunities. Things like battery health checks, managing software updates wirelessly, maybe more work on tires and suspension because EVs are heavier.
So it's not zero service, different service.
Different and likely less frequent and potentially less profitable overall, but not zero. So GPI's strategy is really twofold. Squeeze every drop of profit from the 280 million or so gasoline cars still on U.S. roads, while simultaneously building the skills and capacity to service the EVs of the future. Whether they can manage that transition smoothly, a soft landing, or if they hit that profit cliff, that's the big question over the next decade.
Okay, that's the service side. Hmm. But EVs also bring this other threat, right? The direct consumer model, DTC. Tesla really blew up the traditional dealership model. How big a risk is that for Group One?
It's a significant parallel threat. Tesla proved you can sell cars effectively without franchise dealers. Now, the legacy automakers Ford, GM, etc. are currently tied up by state franchise laws in the U.S. Those laws protect dealers, give them exclusive sales territory.
So those laws are like a protective shield for dealers like GPI.
They are, yes. A very strong regulatory moat currently. But there's a long-term risk. Some argue these laws actually slow down EV adoption and that DTC could mean lower prices for consumers because you cut out the middleman costs.
So the shield might not be permanent. Could those laws change?
It's possible there could be legislative pressure down the road, or manufacturers might push for an agency model where dealers become more like delivery and service points, getting a flat fee per car instead of booking the full revenue and profit from the sale itself. That's another potential disruption.
So how robust is that moat, really, against future changes?
That's the key question. And this is where GPI's strategic pillar of being an OEM partner of choice becomes really important defensively. If they can make themselves absolutely indispensable to Ford or Toyota through great operations and happy customers, it reduces the incentive for those OEMs to try and bypass them.
Makes sense. Keep your partners happy so they don't look elsewhere. Okay, no company operates alone. Let's look at the competition. How does Group One stack up against the other big dealership groups? Who are their main rivals and what makes GPI stand out, if anything?
Yeah, it's crucial to see them in context. It's a competitive field with some very big fish. Their main competitors are the other big public auto retail groups, AutoNation, AN, Penske Automotive Group, Peiji, Lithia Motors, LAD. Those are generally the largest by revenue. Then you also have significant players like Asbury Automotive, ABG, and Sonic Automotive, SAH.
Okay, so GPI isn't the absolute biggest fish in the pond by revenue.
No, generally smaller than AN, Payin, LAD in terms of total revenue. That might mean they lack some of the absolute scale benefits, but maybe it allows them to be a bit more agile, potentially. Each competitor has its own flavor, too.
How so?
Well, Penske is very diversified, big into commercial trucks, large international presence in Europe and Australia. Lithia has been the super aggressive consolidator, just buying up dealerships at a rapid pace. AutoNation has probably the most recognized consumer brand name in the U.S. and is building its own finance company.
So what's Group One's distinct strategy in that mix?
GPI seems more focused on achieving deep regional density, like that number one spot in Texas we talked about. Mm-hmm. And they have this very balanced capital allocation with that heavy emphasis on share buybacks alongside disciplined M&A. It's a slightly different approach.
Okay, let's put some numbers on this. The Q2 2025 data gives us a snapshot comparison. Walk us through some key metrics. Where does GPI shine or maybe lag?
Right. Looking at that Q2 25 comparative dashboard is really revealing. GPI's market cap is smaller than Penske's or Lithia's, around $5.2 billion versus $11 billion or $8 billion respectively. But where they really stood out recently was revenue growth.
They grew faster.
Significantly faster in Q2 25. Their revenue jumped 21.4% year over year. Compare that to AutoNation at 8%, Lithia at 4%, and Penske actually down slightly at 9.4%. So very strong recent top-line momentum for GPI.
Okay, strong growth. What about profitability per car, that GPU metric?
On new vehicle GPU, same-store basis, GPI reported $3,552. That's competitive. It was notably higher than AutoNation's $2,795, though maybe a touch below where Penske was. And crucially, in that high-margin parts and service segment, their gross margin percentage was strong at 56.0%, same store. That suggests really good efficiency in their core profit engine.
So growing fast, holding margins in the key P&S area. Mm-hmm. How about cost control, SG&A selling, general and admin costs?
Their SG&A as a percentage of gross profit, again, same store, was 66.6%. That looks pretty efficient, especially compared to Penske, which was closer to 70%. And translating that down to the bottom line, GPI's adjusted EPS for the quarter was $11.52. That's strong, higher than AN, PEG, and even LAD in that specific quarter. It suggests they're converting revenue to earnings effectively.
In valuation, how does the market price them with a PE ratio?
Their trailing 12-month PE ratio was around 11.3x. That's kind of in the middle of the pack, slightly higher than AN and Lithia, a bit lower than Penske. And their dividend yield, as we mentioned, is low at about 0.5%, reflecting that buyback focus.
So for you, the learner, this dashboard really paints a picture. GPI might not be the biggest name, but they're definitely punching above their weight in some key areas, especially that recent growth and the crucial P&S margins. So what does this tell us about their competitive edge? What are their moats, the things protecting their business?
Despite the tough competition, GPI does have several competitive moats. Mm. The first is that scale and geographic density we keep coming back to. Being number one in Texas isn't just bragging rights. It creates real efficiencies in advertising, inventory, staffing. It builds brand recognition locally and makes it harder for smaller players to compete effectively there. It's a significant barrier to entry in that key market.
Okay, regional dominance is one moat. What else?
Second is their digital capabilities and tech investment. Investing in AcceleRide is key to that seamless omni-channel experience customers increasingly want. And management talking about using AI for productivity and customer interactions shows they're trying to stay ahead technologically, which is crucial in modern retail.
Technology as a moat. And the third one, something unique to this industry.
Indeed. The final, and arguably the strongest moat, is the protected franchise agreements. These state laws giving dealers exclusive rights to sell specific brands in specific areas are powerful. They shield dealers like GPI from direct competition from newcomers and, critically, from the manufacturers themselves selling direct to consumer. It's a strong regulatory moat.
Though, as we discussed, maybe not an absolutely impenetrable one long term.
Precisely. There are question marks about its long-term durability against legislative shifts or changing OEM strategies. But for now, it's a major structural advantage.
All right, let's shift gears again and dive into the financials more deeply. The numbers tell a story of this industry navigating some choppy waters. If we want to understand Group One's financial health and value, what should we be focusing on?
Well, connecting back, the financial data really confirms that normalization story we talked about. But it also highlights just how resilient those high-margin P&S and F&I segments have been so far. The key question this section raises for you is, how sustainable are these financial trends given everything else changing?
Okay, so let's look back first. How did their performance change from, say, the peak year of 2022 to 2023?
It clearly shows that transition. In 2023, total revenues were up nicely, 10.2% growth to $17.9 billion. Good top line.
But the profit didn't keep pace.
Exactly. Gross profit only grew 1.9% in 2023 to $3.02 billion. So revenue up over 10%, gross profit up less than 2%. That means their overall gross margin got squeezed, falling from 18.3% in 2022 down to 16.9% in 2023.
And that flowed through to net income.
It did. Net income fell quite a bit, from $751.5 million in 22 down to $601.6 million in 23. It starkly shows the impact of that GPU compression, selling more cars, but making less profit on each one on average.
Does looking deeper at the segments reinforce the importance of parts and service?
Absolutely. While the profits from selling new and used cars swing quite a bit with inventory and pricing, the P&S segment provides a much more stable, high-margin flow of earnings. It really underscores why management is so focused on growing P&S and controlling SG&A costs. They need that stability to offset the volatility in vehicle sales profit.
Let's talk operational efficiency then.
Yeah.
Things like same-store sales growth, inventory management. How are they doing there more recently?
Same-store growth tells you about the underlying organic performance, excluding acquisitions. In Q2 2025, GPI reported solid consolidated same-store revenue growth of 7.1%, but the real star was P&S.
P&S drove the growth.
Same-store gross profit in P&S surged 14.0% year-over-year. That was fueled by strong customer pay work, up over 13% in both the U.S. and U.K., and also warranty repairs. Vehicle sales growth was much more modest in comparison. New units up 3.6%. Used retail up 4.9% on a same-store basis. It really hammers home that P&S is the main engine of organic profit growth right now.
And inventory. In a normalizing market, you don't want to get stuck with too many cars, right?
Absolutely critical. Too much inventory means high floor plan costs and forces discounting, killing margins. GPI's CEO noted that in Q2 25, their U.S. new vehicle inventory was stable from the prior quarter, sitting at a healthy 48-day supply. That shows disciplined control, enough cars to sell, but not so many that it becomes a burden. That's key operational excellence.
What about the balance sheet? Do they have the financial muscle for their M&A plans and those big share buybacks?
It looks like they do. They maintain a solid financial position. Management points to a rent-adjusted leverage ratio of 2.7x, which they feel gives them plenty of room for more acquisitions without taking on too much debt.
And liquidity. Cash on hand.
Strong. End of Q2 25, they had $1.1 billion in total liquidity. That's a mix of cash, $374 million, and available credit lines, $739 million. That gives them significant flexibility to jump on M&A opportunities when they arise.
And with interest rates being a concern, how is their debt structured? Fixed versus variable?
That's important. As of Q2 25, about 60% of their $5.2 billion in floor plan and other debt was at fixed interest rates. That's a smart move in a rising rate environment. It hedges a big chunk of their interest costs against further rate hikes, giving them more stability.
Okay, solid balance sheet. So how does the market value GPI, given all this? What does the valuation multiples suggest?
Well, auto retailers are cyclical, so PE and price sales ratios are common metrics. As of late July 2025, GPI was trading around 11.3 times its trailing 12-month earnings, PE. We saw earlier this puts them roughly in the middle compared to peers like AutoNation, Penske, and Lithia. Their price-sales ratio was about 0.24x, also broadly in line. It suggests the market sees them similarly to their peers on these basic multiples.
But the E in PE, the earnings, is potentially tricky here, right? Are current earnings sustainable?
That's the key valuation question for any cyclical company. Are we looking at peak earnings, trough earnings, or something sustainable? GPI's trailing 12-month EPS of $36.27 is down from the absolute peak. But analysts are actually forecasting forward EPS to rise, maybe into the $41, $44 range.
How can earnings per share go up if overall profit might be under pressure?
Share buybacks. The consensus view seems to be that their aggressive buyback program will shrink the share count enough to more than offset any further margin compression, leading to continued growth on a per-share basis.
So the buybacks are mechanically supporting the EPS number?
Very much so. But this raises that important question for you, the listener. Does that current PE multiple fully capture the risk if vehicle GPUs don't find a soft landing? What if they revert all the way back to pre-pandemic levels? A careful valuation needs to stress test that scenario.
Run the numbers assuming lower, maybe more historically normal, profit margins.
Exactly. The current valuation seems to factor in the near-term normalization pressure, but it's less clear if it fully accounts for the wide range of outcomes from the EV transition's impact on that all-important P&S business down the road.
Now, beyond standard metrics, there's this unique thing in dealership valuation. Blue sky value. What exactly is that?
Right, blue sky. It's basically the intangible value of a dealership. Things like its reputation, customer lists, and most importantly, the value of its franchise agreement above and beyond the value of its physical assets like buildings and inventory.
So it's like goodwill, but specific to dealerships.
Kind of, yeah. It's typically calculated as a multiple of the dealership's pre-tax earnings. And critically, that multiple varies hugely depending on the brand. Premier brands like Toyota, Lexus, Porsche command really high blue sky multiples because those franchises are so profitable and desirable. Struggling brands, much lower multiples.
So the quality of GPI's brand portfolio directly impacts its underlying blue sky value.
Absolutely. Assessing the mix of their 36 brands is key to estimating the quality and value of these intangible assets. Industry advisors say blue sky values have cooled off a bit from the 2022 peaks, but they're still historically high, supported by the ongoing M&A activity and decent profitability.
And just to circle back one last time to shareholder returns, those buybacks again, how does that complete the valuation picture?
It's central to it. GPI's capital return is overwhelmingly tilted towards buybacks with that modest dividend yield. But you can't just look at the dividend. They bought back 3% of their entire company in just the first half of 2025.
So you need to look at the total return, dividend plus buyback.
Yes, the all-in shareholder yield. For GPI, that's substantial. It's a primary driver of value for shareholders. It increases their ownership stake in the company and provides significant underlying support for the stock price by constantly reducing the number of shares out there.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground, but no investment is risk-free. Group 1 faces challenges. For you, the listener, to be truly informed, we need to clearly lay out the potential roadblocks. What are the key risks that could derail GPI's journey?
And these risks often interact, making the environment complex. The big question is always, can they navigate these headwinds? First, you have the straightforward cyclical and economic risks. Car buying is a major purchase, very sensitive to the economy, consumer confidence, inflation. Management themselves say consumers are under pressure.
And interest rates fall into this category too.
Definitely. High rates dampen demand, can squeeze F&I profits, and raise their own borrowing costs. Floor plan. It's a major headwind.
Okay, economic sensitivity. What about risks specific to the auto industry and their relationships with manufacturers?
Key risks here. The biggest near-term one is probably continued margin normalization. That GPU compression we've discussed, how far does it go, how fast? Then there's OEM dependence. GPI relies heavily on Ford, Toyota, BMW, etc. for cars, incentives, warranty payments, and crucially, the franchise agreements themselves. Supply chain hiccups, policy changes by OEMs, or just souring relationships, all big risks. And don't forget regulatory and legal risks. Complex rules like the FTC's new cars rule or potential changes to state franchise laws could increase costs or force changes to how they operate.
And then the really big picture, long-term structural risks.
This is where the electric vehicle transition looms largest. That potential erosion of the high-margin P&S revenue stream is, arguably, the single biggest long-term threat to the traditional dealer model's profitability. Alongside that is broader technological and business model disruption. The risk of OEMs shifting to DTC or agency models or even new mobility patterns like autonomous cars and ride-sharing, reducing overall car ownership, these could fundamentally reshape demand.
Finally, what about risks specific to GPI's own operations, things they need to manage internally?
As a big acquirer, they face M&A integration risk. Did they pay too much? Can they successfully blend the new dealerships into their culture and systems to get the expected synergies? There's also international operations risk from their UK presence exposure to the UK economy, currency swings, different regulations like specific EV mandates. And lastly, a risk for any big retailer today, cybersecurity risk. They hold tons of customer data. A major breach would be incredibly costly, both financially and reputationally.
Okay, a lot of potential bumps in the road. So for you, the listener, wanting to track GPI's progress navigating all this, what are the absolute key metrics to keep on your personal dashboard?
I'd say definitely watch same-store sales growth, broken down by new, used, and especially P&S. Keep a laser focus on gross profit per unit, GPU, for new and used cars that tells you about margin pressure. Track finance and insurance, F&I, income per unit retailed for profitability there. Monitor SG&A as a percentage of gross profit for cost control. Looked at inventory days supply to gauge inventory management. For P&S, watch technician headcount and the P&S revenue mix, customer pay versus warranty. And finally, keep track of their capital allocation, how much is going to M&A versus buybacks. That shows their priorities.
Excellent list. So let's wrap up this deep dive by revisiting the core questions we aim to explore about Group 1. First, how sustainable are those margins we've talked so much about?
Well, the peak 2021-22 margins, definitely not sustainable. GPU compression is real and likely continues. But, and this is key, the strength and growth in P&S, plus good cost control, could allow GPI to stabilize overall profitability at a level that's structurally higher than before the pandemic, even if vehicle GPUs fall further. It's about finding that new, potentially still healthy, normal level.
And their competitive position, how do they stack up now?
They're strongly positioned as a major second-tier public consolidator, not the absolute biggest, but they have significant scale, that dominant Texas footprint, those protected franchises, and a growing, efficient P&S business. Their strategy seems clear. Regional density, quality brands via M&A, aggressive capital return. They're executing effectively within their chosen strategy.
How well are they handling the huge shifts EVs and digital?
Management is clearly aware and acting. They're investing in Acceleride for the digital side, investing in EV training and tools. That's all necessary. But the sheer scale of the long-term EV challenge to P&S profits is immense. The strategy makes sense, but whether it will be enough to fully offset that potential profit erosion over the long haul, that remains the big uncertainty, the key long-term risk.
What about their ability to keep acquiring? Do they have the capacity and the deals?
Capacity looks robust. That $1.1 billion in liquidity and moderate debt gives them firepower. Management indicated recently that M&A activity was picking up after a lull, suggesting a healthy pipeline. Expect them to continue targeting those disciplined tuck-in deals for a quality franchise that fit their strategy.
And finally, the valuation. Does it fairly reflect the business and its risks?
It's a mixed picture. The low PE reflects the cyclical nature and the normalizing earnings. But those massive buybacks are providing strong underlying support to EPS, making the valuation look perhaps more attractive than it might otherwise. It seems to price in the near-term margin pressures reasonably well. But does it fully capture that binary, long-term risk opportunity around the EV transition's impact on aftersales? That's much less clear.
So what does this all mean for you? We've journeyed through the complexities of Group 1 Automotive, from its nuts and bolts to the huge industry shifts swirling around it. Hopefully, you're now better equipped with the facts and insights to really understand this dynamic sector and one of its key players.
And it really leaves us with a central question to ponder, doesn't it? As the automotive world powers towards electrification, will Group 1's undeniable operational strengths, their discipline, their aggressive shareholder returns, will that be enough to navigate the fundamental structural challenge to their most profitable business, the parts and service segment? Or will that potential profit cliff from EV aftersales ultimately prove too steep a drop?
That's a powerful thought to leave you with. This deep dive into Group 1 Automotive, Inc. really highlights how one company can be a fascinating microcosm of an entire industry undergoing a profound transformation. We hope this has given you plenty to think about and maybe even sparked some curiosity to explore further.